The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and/or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
There'll be spectacle, there'll be fantasy, there'll be derring do and stuff like you would never see.
Hey, a movie!
Yeah, we're gonna be a movie!
Starring everybody
and me. There'll be heroes bold, there'll be comedy, and a lot of fuss that ends for us real happily.
Hey, a movie!
We can watch it all develop.
Starring everybody
and me. We'll take the world. Set it on its ear.
Come on, join in. We're gonna start right here.
And we are gonna start right here. Hello, you are listening to a Rattledge Broadcasting premiere podcast triple feature. I am your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And I am joined by my co-host with the most, he's Sean, you're not. How do you do, Sean Comer?
In other words, you brought in the resident gamer of Rattledge and Broadcasting Network to talk about the movies that are based on some of the greatest video games ever made, and yet just ended up being laughably, literally, historically horrible.
That's right. We are talking Mortal Kombat Annihilation, Street Fighter, and Street Fighter The Legend of Chun-Li. And you're like, hey, what happened to the first Mortal Kombat? Well, we already did that one. When the 2021 Mortal Kombat came out, we did an on-trial for the first one. And I said at the time, I was like, yeah, we don't need to talk about Annihilation. And then a few months ago, Sean and I were plotting out the calendar for the year of our Lord 2024. And I had some ideas. He had some ideas. And this is your baby. This is you're as Jim Cornette says, you're the one fucking this dog. I'm just holding the head. So why are you making me do this?
Well, for starters, you have to watch Mortal Kombat Annihilation to understand why it took us another 15 fucking years to get a full-fledged live action Mortal Kombat movie after this one came out. But also, it's the fact that, you know, if you grew up a gamer nerd, when I did, which is when I grew up a gamer nerd, which I am, you at some point played Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat fairly extensively. Even if you were just fucking around at a friend's house, even if it was just a lazy Saturday with a SNES and a 12-pack of Pepsi, even if you never exactly had ambitions of going forward and becoming a pro like some did, you knew these two games. You at the very least knew of them. And you especially knew of Street Fighter because Street Fighter, and this is absolutely not exaggeration, invented fighting games as we know them today. There is not, I think, a single fighting game franchise you can name that would exist without the first game coming out in, I'm crappy with dates, I believe it was 85, it made an impression. it made an impression as a game with a solid concept, but that just absolutely stumbled and shat itself in execution, like practically every step of the way.
Yeah, I played both of these. I played Mortal Kombat. And I played a couple of iterations of this. We probably talked about it in the on trial.
Well, right.
And I definitely played Street Fighter. Actually, I remember there was like a T-Ammo down the block from my house that was, you know, within walking distance. And that first Street Fighter game, I shoved a lot of quarters into. My most visceral memory of playing Street Fighter is actually watching another friend of mine play against this kid at the arcade. And it's so funny because I it wasn't just a game. Like, this became like a competitive sport for a lot of people. And I remember there was this one kid and he really owned the machine. He was beating everyone's ass. And my friend beat him one game. And I was like, hey, man, good for you. And I remember the other kid was so mad at me. He was like, oh, go kiss your girlfriend while you're at it. Like, easy. Like, it's just, so, I'm just happy he won a video game. Like, calm down.
So when you're talking Street Fighter, are we talking like the original Street Fighter, the broken, janky mess of a very first game? Or are we talking about Street Fighter 2?
Both. I played both in the arcade.
Okay.
And my favorite character was Blanka. I love, you know, any big green monsters. Well, I don't know if anyone knows this about me, but I'm a huge fan of the Hulk. And so, you know, I love the idea that he just crouched down and generated electricity. It was a fun way to beat people. But I also played. I also used Honda a lot too, because, you know, big fat guy sumo wrestler.
Both of them doing, fun.
Yeah, doing ultimate biffs. You ever biff somebody or get biffed when you were in school? Boy, nothing would aggravate people more than getting slapped right in the head. But you were saying,
And what you had with these two games was you had two different approaches to something ambitious about fighting games. And that's the notion of world building, of story, and of lore. In Street Fighter, they very purposely built, and I attribute a lot of this to the fact that it is a Japanese game. And so there's a lot of that anime and manga bombast, and there's a very frenetic atmosphere that's meant to suggest that a street fight could break out at literally just about any time. And Street Fighter is almost an occupation like I'm a busker, or I'm a sidewalk painter, or, you know, I hustle pool, something like that.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah,
it's sort of an off the beaten path question, but I was thinking about the game, and then I was thinking about what's going to happen next in the culture, because there's these different fighting styles. You had sumo, you had karate, you had whatever it was the Indian guy was doing. You know, you had a fair amount of different fighting styles. You had Zangief was your wrestler. And the next thing that's going to happen is the Ultimate Fighting Championships, where there were no rules and it was mixed martial arts and a giant cage competition. And I'm wondering if anyone's ever thought about a through thread from the Street Fighter game to the development of mixed martial arts competitions.
I mean, it's worth a thought. I mean, if we're talking about going back to the UFC, yeah, Street Fighter preceded the UFC by a few years. But if you're talking about the advent of MMA, you being a scholar of combat sports that you are, you know that shit goes clear back to the 60s.
Sure.
Depending on which fight you want to cite as being the seminal MMA fight. Probably even further than that, I think, if we're talking about
There's always been like
about Gracie versus Kimura.
Yeah, well, I was gonna say there's always been like mixed styles of things, you know, boxers, wrestlers and shit like that, you know, George.
Yeah, but I mean
I fully
believe that, yeah, there were probably kids that were growing up playing Shotokan Karate as Ken or Ryu, or Muay Thai as Sagat, or they were a grappler like Zangief, and maybe that did motivate them to, or maybe even a boxer like Balrog.
I just have this like thought in my head, you know, like there's this person with money watching his kid shove quarter after quarter to Street Fighter and thinking, hey, the kid seemed to like, you know, this mixed combat sport shit. Maybe we can make money with this.
I feel like at some point, I mean, I'm a, no secret, I'm a big Napoleon Bonaparte fan, and his MMA docs are always littered with street. He once used Street Fighter as a means of explaining the martial arts rivalry between Japan and Brazil over Brazil inventing their form of jiu-jitsu.
Anyway, you were saying.
Anyway. But so, yeah, so with Street Fighter, you've got this kind of big, chaotic, but really fun and colorful and bombastic, anime and manga style spectacle. Whereas with Mortal Kombat, you've got, number one, much more dramatic lore. In Street Fighter, you had lore in terms of the overall stakes and the overarching story, the reason for the tournament. but most of it comes down to kind of interlocking connections between characters, most of which you only gleaned from either getting the arcade endings or from the instruction manual. Because, of course, back then, full-fledged story modes, the likes of what we get now, are, you know, they were a pipe dream. But with Mortal Kombat, you've got this much bigger interlocking story of a war between Earthrealm and, you know, Outworld. And you've got this clash to save kind of all existence as we know it. And within that, you've also got these violent blood feuds. You've got people who are at the tournament to seek out retribution, very specifically. Others who are strictly there just to try to save our reality. But the violence was, at the same time that the strikes had a much more real impact, owing a lot to the digitized graphics and the unique presentation of the game and the much darker, grittier, grimy atmosphere, you also had the ultra bloody fatalities, which, while they, I hesitate to call them cartoonish because that kind of evokes a different sort of aesthetic, it was just more so they were over the top, emphatic, and a way to definitely say, oh yeah, he dead. And of course, Mortal Kombat kind of went a lot further in terms of laying out that lore over the ensuing games than Street Fighter did, where the stories in Street Fighter are much more towards the background. And there's something that you kind of experience more just by playing each character's different ladder and seeing how they interact, what their end cutscene is going to be at the end of the game, where it's not necessarily just about beating Bison. You're a little more invested in, you know, will Ryu find that ultimate strong opponent that truly gives him the answers about himself that he craves? Will Chun-Li avenge her father? Will Blanca understand his true identity? Will Honda prove the superiority of Sumo? I'm sorry, that was about a 10,000 word answer to a tweet.
All right, let's move this on. We're going to talk about Mortal Kombat first, get that out of the way. Yeah. Mortal Kombat Annihilation is a 1997 American martial arts fantasy film directed by John R. Leonetti in his directorial debut. It's obviously based on the video game, and it's the second installment in the Mortal Kombat film series, a sequel to the 1995 film, on which Leonetti served as cinematographer. Largely adapted from the 1995 video game Mortal Kombat 3, Annihilation follows Liu Kang and his allies as they attempt to prevent the malevolent Shao Kahn from conquering Earthrealm. It stars Robin Cho as Liu, Talisa Soto as Katana, James Remar as Raiden, Sandra Hess as Sonya Blade, Lynn Red Williams as Jax, Brian Thompson as Kong. Only Shao and Soto reprise their roles with the other characters recast from the previous film. This was made on a budget of $30 million. The box office was 51.3, so this was a bomb, even though it made more than its production budget. It lost money with marketing and all of that. And I just want to read this really quick before we get into the craft review, which I thought was kind of interesting. In an interview for Luke Owen's book, Lights, Camera, Game Over, producer Lawrence Kasdanoff revealed the film was released unfinished. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, the effects in that movie are not the final effects. I never anticipated that someone would take the movie and go, it's good enough. We weren't done. We never finished that movie. But the studio said, we don't care. We sacrificed quality for business, which I thought was interesting.
You don't say.
You know, here's my here's my thoughts on Mortal Kombat Annihilation. If you are looking for at least the same tone and depth as the first one, yeah, it fails miserably. It's awful. If taken on its own and compared to maybe the Power Rangers and all of that silliness, like all of the Rita Repulsa overacting, the shoddy, almost comical special effects, if you are looking at Mortal Kombat Annihilation and thinking it's a kid's movie on par with the average Power Ranger episode,
you're not wrong.
Mortal Kombat Annihilation works so much better. Because again, I'm watching this and about a third of the way through it, I stopped thinking about it as a movie for adults. I started thinking about it as a movie for when my son was really into Power Rangers, yeah, and he was seven at the time.
But with like a license, but with a licensed movie, that takes so much mental gymnastics to get to
that. Yeah, I'm kind of in my on trial mode at this point where I'm trying to see the positive in this movie.
And I get it. And look, I mean, if we were adapting a Sentai franchise, like even a dark-ish Sentai franchise, mm-hmm, of some kind or another, I'm not that deep into Sentai, so insert whatever the hell you think fits there. Yeah, then this would work just fine. But the fact is, you can't get around that this is a Mortal Kombat movie that's playing out like a Sentai. And that's fucking awful.
Let me, a couple of things. So what am I talking about exactly? Yeah. When I think about, God, what was Katana's mother in this?
Sindel.
Sindel. Oh, I just kept getting Rita Repulsa vibes. Like, that woman is trying her fucking level best. Maybe don't let the cinematographer direct people. Because, like, he is just letting performances happen and giving very basic instruction here. And these people are doing their level best with shoddy material. This plot, like, I didn't realize it was adapted strictly from like an actual video game. This is actually adapted from Mortal Kombat 3 because it plays like a fucking video game. And there is an art to adapting the story of a video game into a feature-length motion picture. This failed. This very much, you know, it's been a while since I've had to reference him, and most people at this point probably don't remember who he is, but Confused Matthew's criticism about some movies of, I felt like I was forced to watch a video game I couldn't play. Yeah, this was like, this is like watching one of my son's like Let's Plays, where I'm watching each of the main characters kind of go from fight to fight, and the fights are okay-ish. But for the most part, the stuff holding this together is, again, it's like a cross between a bad video game and someone's third grader asked to write a Mortal Kombat screenplay.
The first movie did a much better job of pacing it out and limiting the scope of characters, we'll be coming back to that, to the point where throughout the movie, you always had a sense of each of them developing and kind of fighting their own battle. Lou's survivor's guilt, Johnny's complex about his worth as a martial artist, Sonya's vendetta with Kano, and refusal to ask for help from absolutely anybody. And on the other side, you've even got, you know, obviously Shang Tsung and Goro are out to conquer Earthrealm. Kano just wants to torment Sonya. Scorpion and Sub-Zero are at the beck and call of Shang Tsung. Whereas in this one, they take some of the developments from the lore of the previous games, but they got it into their head that just mentioning them offhand would be enough. They mention Cabal just kind of offhand as somebody who's just been taken off the board. Cabal's a fucking interesting character, with some layered allegiances and motivations throughout the tournament. They introduce Kuai Liang, the second Sub-Zero, who is the younger brother of the first one who died in the original game and tournament and the movie. Nothing is ever done with that, or with the fact that Scorpion is supposed to realize that's not the same Sub-Zero that he killed. And so realizing that he was an honorable man after all, he makes it his vow that he's going to watch after and protect Kuai Liang as he progresses through the tournament. it's just everything is just so snap, 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 so fast, 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 that nothing gets time to develop because they tried to wedge every possible character from the expanded rosters of 2 and 3 that they didn't get
The Nightwolf stuff was so bad. It was like, go see.
Oh, God.
Go see Nightwolf. And then it was like, he shows up and they fight because we've gone 2 minutes. We have to have another fight scene. And then I'm like, okay, the way to get Katana back and the way to do whatever it is, whatever else you need to do to defeat the bad guys is you have to pass these 3 tests. Mm-hmm. And involved in one of those tests is, I think, Jade, who's also a double agent working for the enemy. And I'm like, this is convoluted in a way that only a child would you know, envision it. Like, if you remember when you were a little kid, if you had friends and you socialized and you went out to play, you know, and I've used this sort of metaphor before where it's like, well, I've got a ray gun. Well, I've got a shield that deflects your ray gun. Well, I've got a, you know, and it just goes back and forth. It's kind of a lot of that. It's like, I just remember playing with my friends, you know, and it's like, oh, but I betrayed you. Like, we're also overdramatic. That kind of shit's in this movie. Like, when Jade leads them into the bad guy's fortress and then turns on them, he's like, I was the author of all your pain, James. Like, oh my God. Like, it's so bad. It's like, the other thing I was thinking about was, you know, Americanized Japanese, like, martial arts movies, or, you know, Chinese martial arts movies where, like, we get, you know, something is very popular overseas and it gets redone for American audiences, and there is just a missing piece between in the translation to where the people remaking the original martial arts movie don't understand why that martial arts movie was popular. They just aped the movie and did more martial arts stuff, thinking that's all there is to it. And an example of this would be, it's not the world's greatest example, but like Spike Lee's Old Boy. Like, I have heard people talk about like the original, like the Korean version, and how awesome it is. And then people watched the Spike, and Jason and I reviewed it, and it's like, we see that Spike Lee really likes this movie, but I don't think he knows why people like it as much as they do.
We're both aficionados to some extent or another of martial arts movies. It's that emotional content, baby.
Right. Yeah.
The first
about the Godzilla Minus One, where make as many Godzilla films as you want. If you don't understand why these movies work on an emotional level, you're missing a key element.
Well, yeah. In the first, I'm going to preface this by saying I cannot discuss martial arts fight scenes with quite the same eloquent statement of intricacies that a David Wright or an Andrew Graham usually manages. I always appreciate doing action movies with those two because they really break that stuff down.
Sure.
Because they really are devout, lifelong martial artists. Whereas I, on the other hand, the last martial arts I took was Taekwondo in second grade. But I can recognize when the choreography of a fight scene is very clearly telling a story. When I like to think of it as there's a causality to absolutely everything that happens, and it all builds to a logical conclusion, to where you can follow a flow, to where this shot is set up that way for a very specific reason. It's blocked this way for a very specific reason. Nothing that I watched in Mortal Kombat Annihilation felt like anything more than some kind of studio stunt show where they just got a bunch of actors together who could fit into the costumes, who didn't understand anything about how a fighting style can say something about that person's character, and why that's why, even if you look at the games, why Johnny Cage doesn't fight like Shao Kahn, who doesn't fight like Kung Lao, who doesn't fight like Scorpion, who doesn't fight like Cyrax. It's just who can land the kicks, who can hit their marks, who looks good in the costume. And you can tell the immediate difference and everything that was lost by the fact that no Christopher Lambert, obviously, no Cary Fukugawa, no Lyndon Ashby as Johnny Cage, no Bridget Wilson as Sonya Blade. No, you will get your Robin Shu and your Talisa Soto, and you will fucking like it.
It's really
The
reason why I was comparing it to one of the reasons why I was comparing it to the Power Rangers is for every fight scene, they always did the same thing. Hi-ya! And that was it. Mm-hmm. That, like, that's the extent of the martial arts here. We're doing like basic punching and kicking and a lot of flips. And I'm watching this, and it's literally the same fight choreography. It's hi-ya before everything. And then a bunch of punching, kicking, and flipping. Well, you're right, with really no commitment to any one martial art style. It is like it's wall karate.
Now compare that to let's throw out a classic, shall we? Compare that to, say, Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David in They Live.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, it's an insane brawl, but it's believable. It has a story to it. It has something you can follow. To paraphrase Jim Cornette, if you're driving by, you might see two fellas just fighting out on the side of the road. And to everybody else, it's just a couple of guys just having a brawl. But maybe you know that one guy who's getting his ass kicked, and you know that he's a good man, and you don't want to see him get hurt. And you know the other guy, you know he's a fucking prick, and you've been wanting to see somebody shut his fucking mouth for him. That's why you stop, that's why you watch, that's why you cheer. That's telling a good story through a fight. At no fucking point does this movie give a shit about any of that.
No. It was just to hear that quote I read at the start of the conversation, then we'll move on, that they rushed this thing out. I mean, this thing came out in 1997. I think what was like the first one was the 1995. Yeah. So like this is still, I'm in college when this is going on, and Mortal Kombat's still really popular. Fighting games are really popular. They explode around this time. Mm-hmm. Whether it's in the arcade or it's for a home system of some kind, PlayStation or whatever. And the fact that they were absolutely like rushing this out to capitalize on it with that, movie executive lizard brain of they will come if we put it in theaters because they love this franchise so much. And let me go ahead. I was just on the Movies That Don't Suck and Some That Do podcast. I said it then. I'm going to say it again. People don't care about race. They don't care about gender. They don't care about any of that stuff. What they care is that the thing that they like be well represented on screen. That's it. That's what's most important to anyone. And they like well-told stories and cool characters. Mm-hmm. If you don't do that much, they're not coming. You can put as many Mortal Kombat movies in theaters that you want and rush them out and put them on the assembly line. But if they don't see the characters that they played in the game well represented on screen in a story that's engaging, then it's going to bomb. And that's exactly what happened here. They rushed this out to capitalize on the Mortal Kombat craze. They sacrificed quality for quantity, essentially, and they tarnished the product. Because we don't get another Mortal Kombat theatrical exhibition until the year of our Lord 2021. And for that review, go into our archives and hear me and Robert nearly kill each other.
I would end it on this. If you doubt if you're somebody who's from outside the gaming sphere, who's doubting what I'm saying about fighting games actually having good stories, my challenge to you is this, and I'm going to do this a little bit throughout the show. I'm going to try to credit both my sources and better spin-off media from these franchises that you can go and check out and probably have a better time. If you have some time to kind of serialize something and break it up into chunks, go to YouTube and just search Mortal Kombat cutscene movie. And I guarantee you will be brought to someone who has cut together all of the cutscenes from Mortal Kombat 9, 10, 11, and the sequel/reboot that just came out. This came out last year, Mortal Kombat 1. I point that out because the first Mortal Kombat game of the rebooted saga basically retold the stories of the first three games all in one story. And it comes out to about a couple of hours. And it's actually really pretty well done. NetherRealm was still kind of figuring out character modeling at the time, but the story is excellent. 10 is a fantastic continuation of that story. 11 is the third act of the saga. It kind of brings everything all the way around, ties up all the loose ends, and it sets the stage for Mortal Kombat 1 to restart everything and start telling a whole new sweeping epic. Check that out. Go check out the 1995 movie. Mortal Kombat 2021 it's better on a second viewing, I think. It sets the stage well for Mortal Kombat 2, I think, probably being pretty good. And there was one of the live action series that I think it was the one that was on TNT, and I always get the titles mixed up. But they're both on Max. Check them both out. And last but not least, I would also say if you really want to hear more of what went on behind the scenes, can't recommend enough, check out Matt McMuscles and his episode of What Happened that was dedicated to Annihilation. It goes in much greater depth, direct sources, covers about everything if we haven't convinced you to just avoid this entirely.
Or, I'm just going to throw this out there and immediately going into Street Fighter.
Yep.
If you have a son between the ages of 6 and 8, and he likes Power Rangers and karate, throw on Mortal Kombat Annihilation and have yourself a time. Let him watch it while you put away laundry. Everyone will be happy. Everyone
kept Jonas off your back, did it?
It's so funny, actually. He's pissed at me because I had to get all three of these watched before tonight's show, and he had school and I had time off during the day, so that's when I watched them.
Oh, you had to watch them without him.
And I had to watch them without him, and he was just like, wait, I wanted to watch Street Fighter with you. And I'm like, we'll watch them again. We'll watch them again. Same thing with Mortal Kombat Annihilation. Actually, I don't know. Like, he's a brainy kid. Like, Wednesday night, we went to go see a re-airing of Dune. Not the David Lynch version, the 2021 version. Because he was, 21, he was, he had to be, like, 7, I think, at the time. 7 or 8. And, you know, like, he was there, and he was watching, and I remember he was, like, bouncing in his chair. Yeah, I just cut the TikTok on this, and I was talking about it. He was, you know, my daughter fell asleep, and he was bouncing in his chair. So I happened to mention that they were doing a one night showing of Dune 2021 in IMAX theaters with a sneak peek at Dune 2. Ooh. And he said to me, he's like, will you take me again? I'm excited for Dune. I don't remember a lick of that first movie. I was like, sure, let's go see it again. So I might have been able to watch these with him on Wednesday, but we went to go see Dune instead. And I think it was time better spent. Quite frankly.
Yeah, fair.
But we also just got finished watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And it was so funny. He pulled me aside. It was after watching Dune 2.5 hours and then watching all, you know, 97 hours of the Lord of the Rings. He was like, I have decided I don't like long movies. I understand why you like them, Dad. And I'm not saying these are bad movies. I'm saying I personally check out after about 2 hours. And I'm like,
you know what?
You're allowed. You're almost 10.
Yeah. You're allowed your taste.
Yeah. Look, I mean, how many of us could have sat through a 3-hour movie when we were 10 years old without wanting to stab your father?
So I only did it once or twice, and the first one that comes to mind was probably Hunt for Red October, I think was the closest I got.
Yeah. All right, so Street Fighter is the next movie. We're going to spend more time on this than the other two movies, especially
after this.
Street Fighter is a 1994 action film written and directed by Stephen E. D'Souza, obviously based on the game of the same name, produced by Capcom. It was one of two films released in 1994, specifically adapting Street Fighter II, following Street Fighter II, the animated movie. It's distributed by Universal. It stars Jean-Claude Van Damme and Raul Julia in his final theatrical film, final theatrical role, alongside supporting performances by Byron Mann, Damien Chapa, Kylie Minogue, Ming-Na Wen of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fame, and Wes Studi. The adaptation focuses on the efforts by Colonel Guile to bring down General Bison, the military dictator and drug kingpin of Shadaloo City, who aspires to conquer the world with an army of genetic super soldiers, because that was in at the time, while enlisting the aid of Street Fighters Ryu and Ken to infiltrate Bison's empire and help destroy it from within. It was commercially successful. It had on a budget of $35 million, it made almost $100 million and spawned the aforementioned sequel, which bombed entirely. So, Sean, the fun of talking about Street Fighter is the development history, of which you have studied hard and long and have a lot to say about it. So take it away, Sean.
Jesus fucking Christ. This is why I understand sometimes when studios say, when we make adaptations, we make licensed media, we sometimes want to keep source material owners out of the room when we can. Because you can't actually pin this one on Stephen A. D'Souza. He is a pretty rabid Street Fighter fan. He came in with a deep, you know, granular understanding of the games and the characters' histories, their backstories, and who they really were, and had an idea for a movie that he wanted to make that would really capture the spirit of the games. Capcom did not want to do this. They wanted to make a Street Fighter movie that was more akin to a James Bond-style action espionage epic. And D'Souza, I guess, so badly wanted to make a Street Fighter movie that he just went, yeah, okay. By the way, I should take the time to mention here that my sources here are going to come from a combination of Polygon's legendarily amazing complete oral history of Street Fighter, or I believe just called Street Fighter, a complete oral history. A lot of it comes from the absolutely epic deep dive by Thorgy's Arcade as part four of their, I believe we're now up to, estimated to be somewhere between 6 and 8 part Street Fighter retrospective that's currently running at about 2 hours per episode. Devoted an entire episode just to this movie, the short segment on the other movies, and Street Fighter, the movie, the game. And also, again, this is another one that Matt McMuscles has covered over on his channel. Could not recommend it highly enough. Probably one of the most knowledgeable, hardworking gaming YouTubers working today. Anyway, so then next they get around to talking about casting, and Capcom is dreaming big. They're talking about wanting to get Schwarzenegger and or Stallone for their Street Fighter movie with their Street Fighter movie budget. D'Souza narrowly manages to not laugh at them openly. And they kind of go down the hierarchy, and the first action star they come to who will work for what they're offering is Jean-Claude Van Damme.
That tracks. How far after Bloodsport and Kickboxer does this come out?
It was a fair ways, and it was also a good ways into his coke addiction, too. We'll get to that.
Okay.
With the rest of the cast, really the only two they were kind of targeting right from the beginning were Jean-Claude Van Damme and, of course, the late legendary Raoul Julliet. Van Damme playing Colonel Guile and Julliet playing M. Bison. They got a couple other stars in there. They got you brought up Kylie Minogue. That wasn't some daring stunt casting. That was, they realized roughly, I think, a day or two before they were to start filming in Thailand that they hadn't cast a role yet, and Kylie happened to be on the cover of the In-Flight magazine.
But
no, this is documented. This is how this
I believe you, but it's like the joke about, like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger or like Bill Clinton, and you know, mm-hmm. and who they cheated on their wives with. It was like they grabbed the first broad that walked into the room, so it happened to be the maid,
basically,
you know, or the intern, like just looking around, going, "Who's available?"
The most famous dichotomy between Julliet and Van Damme was they had a guy on set who said, I had two jobs. Make sure that Mr. Julien took his meds and make sure that Van Damme was off his. This man actually at one point had a PA whose one job on the set, his one and only job, was to make sure that Jean-Claude Van Damme didn't get zonked out of his gourd while he was supposed to be shooting. You can first off, you can tell by watching the movie how great that went. But second, that experiment lasted a full day before you know what happened. Van Damme got the motherfucker high off his tits.
That's one way to deal with
the gambler. The supposition has been that either A, this was a scam that he ran repeatedly, in that the idea being, you know, if he hung around and he got the nice celebrities who were shooting in Thailand drugs, he might get a chance to do drugs with them and they might even buy him drugs.
At least it was just drugs and not underage children.
Yeah.
Also very popular in Thailand at the time.
The other big problem with Van Damme was the fact that D'Souza kind of tried to dissuade them from hiring him, not because of the coke, but because I don't know if you ever heard Jean-Claude Van Damme speak.
It's like the Dolph Lundgren line, you know, when they gave Dolph Lundgren, I think, the He-Man part, and Stallone's like, you gave him lines?
And he's playing the fucking American Jarhead. And he tried to kind of gently bring this up to the Capcom executives. And of course, it's the Capcom of Japan executives. They're like, what are you talking about? He doesn't have an accent. And then it took a while for kind of one and one to come together and make two. And he realized, oh shit, when they're Japanese, when they've been watching Van Damme movies, they've been dubbed.
That's great.
Of course they don't think he has an accent. The shoot in Thailand itself was a miserable experience because, for one thing, the ever-present threat of a coup, an actually very real, potentially very violent, volatile coup, forced them to rethink and completely reshoot several scenes because they came to the very sound realization that a line of choppers buzzing a village buoyed by guerrilla revolutionaries start some shit.
It's really funny.
Of course the weather was hot and miserable. The living conditions were not ideal. Raul actually showed up because at the time he was already battling stomach cancer. Mm-hmm. He showed up too emaciated to initially fit into the bison suit. So they had to held off a lot of the shooting until they could move everything to Australia, at which point he could bring along his family, basically treat it like a vacation. He could recover for a bit, put some weight back on, and then come in and do business. But essentially the Thai shoot was just a start to finish absolute unmitigated disaster. It didn't get better when they had to somehow wrangle the entire cast to go digitize their performances for Street Fighter the movie, the game, because one after another realized, oh, so you want us to go through this entire hellacious martial arts shoot that is being held together by unicorn farts and the dreams of children. And now you want us to go do mocap for your little... Okay, fine. You can have... The best ones, I think, were saying, okay, you can have exactly one day of my time and we're fucking done. You better get it in one take. The merchandise that was literally just repurposed G.I. Joes that had been repainted and retooled to half-ass match up with the aesthetic of this awful, awful movie. But at the same time, I do have to bring up the one good thing about it. It cannot be said enough. Raoul Julliet had one more good one in him, and this was it. And he famously literally did it for his kids. I heard the interview clip today where he really did tell the story of how his kids were big fans of the game. He didn't know anything about it. He told them about the part, and they were just so absolutely pumped about it that he, I guess, wanted to use the sunset of this time in his life to give his kid, to give his family something that they could really enjoy. And you know what? Does it have its cheese? Oh yeah, this is a fucking triple whopper here. But at the same time, there are moments where it's like it's an objectively good performance.
Oh, he's much better than he has any right to be.
Oh,
he's,
yeah.
He's better than this film.
Oh, by far. The line, the famously meme line, for me it was Tuesday.
Oh yeah. So I was watching that yesterday with my girlfriend. She came over to hang out for a little bit, and that line came on, and like I didn't realize that was in this movie. Like, I'd forgotten about it because like Robert says it all the time. Robert says it on Damn You Hollywood fairly regularly. He was like, you know, that was the worst day for you, but for me, it was a Tuesday. And like, I never thought, because I just want to move on sometime for whatever it is we're discussing or whatever tangent we went on. So I never think to ask him, where are you? Kind of like you. You know, I go back and I listen to our old shows, and you're constantly telling me about Saban suplexing a train. And not once do I ask you what the fuck you're talking about.
Really? You never got that joke?
Not even a one. I still don't. I still think you're talking about Chris Saban from TNA. So,
oh my god, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I never thought to ask you about it because I just wanted to move on. But you know, I would be like, oh yeah, and Ozzy snorted a line of ads. You're like, well, Chris Saban suplexed a train, and I'm thinking to myself, who is Saban? You know, but so going back to the thing that I want to move on from. So Robert always says, like, for me it was a Tuesday. That is an amazing line. That is the best line of the entire movie.
Oh, that's a banger.
Yeah.
Also a slightly lesser shout out to, let's just go down the line. Van Damme's performances, kids don't touch Coke.
All right. Let me stop you there. Cause it sounds like you're done with production notes and I want to get into the craft thing.
Yeah. I really am. Yeah.
Okay. So this is an awful movie for one reason and one reason only. This isn't a Street Fighter movie. This is a mockbuster G.I. Joe.
And I couldn't have put it better.
And that's not what Street Fighter is. You know, ooh. I would love somebody to take the Street Fighter thing, Street Fighter IP, and try again and actually make a fucking tournament movie. Because, like I said, this was somebody's like bad G.I. Joe script that they threw Street Fighter characters into to the point where it's almost porn quality. Like, let's make sure these characters here. And I have to bring this up before you cut me off. I have to bring this up because it was the funniest fucking laugh out loud moment of the film for me. And again, it's that almost porn quality of, as long as we get the aesthetic right, as long as we get the costume right, nothing else matters.
Didn't even get that.
Well, hang on, Balrog. That's the one I'm thinking because it made me laugh out loud hard at this, because it was one of those things where it's like, it's the final fight. Everything is hot, wet, and on fire. Everyone's fighting. There's an army of goons being beat up by all the Street Fighter characters. This motherfucker took time to put on gym shorts, a muscle shirt, and boxing gloves. Because that's what he looks like in the game, where he's fighting because he's a boxer.
Well, okay.
And I'm thinking to myself, not even in G.I. Joe, not even in G.I. Joe did someone take the time to put on boxing gloves to fight Cobra.
Well, okay, yeah. Here's another production note for you. They had to reshoot a lot of scenes because they realized something. They didn't have any of the signature moves of the game.
Right.
And you know, that's something that's kind of unique about fighting games. You know what makes a whole lot of these characters iconic, recognizable, the go-to thing that people pick when they play the game? It's their fucking signature moves.
Right.
And they all of a sudden got to literally the end of the shoot, and they realized that they didn't have much of anything with the characters in their signature costumes, except for obviously Bison and kind of sort of maybe Guile, I guess.
Cammy's wearing short shorts.
Again, wedge that one in near the end.
Yeah, Chun-Li's in the wrong color.
But I mean, they at least gave Bison the right personality, despite the fact that there was no evil overarching real estate related scheme.
Land.
Honda was not an affable Hawaiian. He was a big, pure Japanese sumo who wanted to prove his sports superiority.
Yeah.
DJ was a good guy, not a Bison flunky, although, God, all love to Miguel A. Nunez Jr. Ooh, baby. That's all I got to say.
He's trying so hard. Ooh,
baby. He overcame them damn enchiladas. he did it for us.
This is Street Fighter in name only, and that's my biggest criticism of it.
Yeah.
My second thing is it's a meandering, not all that interesting, overlong story. It's like I'm watching this with my girlfriend, and she liked The Beekeeper. The Beekeeper, you know, so it's not like a violent movie thing, it's not an action movie thing. And I said, hey, I gotta go see this movie, you wanna come with? And I took her to go see Jason Statham's new movie. She's like, that was awesome. She's sitting here watching Street Fighter with me, and she was like, what garbage did you subject me to? And it's because like this is again, this was somebody's bad like 80s throwback commando military script, you know, or like bad G.I. Joe script that they shoved the Street Fighter characters into. And it's like this needed another pass through editing. Mm-hmm. This needed a rewrite. There's a tight script in here, but it is just it's one of those where it's serving too many masters and doing none of them effectively.
You are not wrong, because what happened was when they were making, again, Stephen A. D'Souza is a smart man. Mm-hmm. He knew what he was trying to do, but Capcom execs at some point just decided, no, my movie. He initially tried to tell them, focus on the core 7 characters. That's the absolute most that any audience, the most information any audience is going to be able to retain is, you know, those 7 characters' art. That's your upper limit. And in fact, you'd be better off maybe going with five or six. But Capcom, I think, was about 2 or 3 Street Fighter II re-releases into the game's run. And, of course, with almost every new re-release came at least one new character. So they're just little by little trying to suggest, hey, you know, since you got this scene and you got a couple more minutes you got to fill out, why don't you throw a little something with this character there? And then later it was, well, now that we've established this character, why don't we just give him something else to do? And Before you know it, you have the same problem as Annihilation. You have not given anyone's story room to breathe. Not that, you know, with the fact that you've gotten every single character's core story fucking wrong, except for Guile's. And even then, Blanco was not his best friend Charlie. Blanco was a rich kid whose plane crashed in the Amazon, and he survived by living amongst the tribe's people and eating electric eels. No, really, that's his backstory. Ryu and Ken were not a couple of ne'er-do-well con men. Ken was a spoiled American playboy who was basically a world-renowned martial artist as a lark, and Ryu is always seeking out the next strongest opponent that he can possibly fight and learn something about himself from. Often it's Ken, and in fact, there's a long-standing rivalry with Sagat. Ryu is the reason why Sagat in the game has the big fucking scar on his chest. Because he was the first man to ever beat him. And he Shoryukened him and, you know, carved something out of his chest that looks like my cancer scar. but you don't have room to let it breathe, really, that Chun-Li is out to avenge her father's death. Nothing like that. So what you get is, basically shitty Street Fighter cross G.I. Joe parody porn. I think I just invented a genre.
No, you didn't invent shit. That's been around for a while.
Then I invented a Pornhub search for myself later.
Yeah, you did. That you very much did. And just throw trans in there and you're all set for the night. A couple of nice things I can say about this movie. Ming-Na Wen's trying as hard as she can. Ming-Na Wen
always,
I think, is an underrated actress.
You have nothing bad to say about Ming.
I forgot she was in this, and then I saw her, I was like, oh, well, there's a bright spot. Because Ming-Na Wen may not always pick the world's greatest projects to do, but she's always a shining light in any.
She never phones it in. No.
She's a good-looking gal. She is athletic. And she brings gravitas to any role she takes. And look, her storyline is dopey, but she brings enough gravitas to it that I'm with her. And it's one of the saving graces of this movie, because I'm not with Guile at all.
I will throw in that you could say plenty about Jean-Claude Van Damme's acting. Hell, now that he's clean and sober and possesses a level of self-awareness and introspection Steven Seagal couldn't dream of, most lucid states, I think even he would be very honest about that. But when it comes to actually delivering in the fight scenes where it counts, no, Seagal is on, or not Seagal, fuck me, Van Damme is really kind of on point all the way through.
What I was going to say is, like, Guile doesn't have a story. He's generic action hero guy doing generic action hero stuff, and the best thing that he does is Guile's flip kick. Ming-Na Wen actually has like a plausible story. The other than the fact that it's Raul Julia giving an actual dope line, part of the reason why for me It Was Only Tuesday worked so well is because you're with Ming-Na Wen in her story about avenging her dad and how much pathos she's bringing to that really goofy role. So when she's like, I have been, there's something else where I saw a very similar thing, where it's like, I have been, that was Thanos. It was Thanos and the Scarlet Witch, where, the Scarlet Witch is just like, you hurt me in all kinds of ways. You took everything I loved in Thanos, because this Thanos hasn't met her. I don't even know who you are. Like, it's that kind of a thing. And it was the same thing with Ming-Na Wen. It was like, I have been driven to the ends of the earth to find you and kill you because you've hurt me so badly. It was like, you and that situation mean nothing to me.
If you really want to see a terrific example of somebody bringing all of the stories of Street Fighter together into a fairly cohesive whole, seriously, go check out Street Fighter 2, the animated movie, the very first anime, the one that far preceded this one. It sticks pretty tightly to the lore of the games. It's centered on the idea of Bison trying to track down the perfect fighter to psychically transfer his consciousness into. And in particular, he's really targeting Ryu for this particular purpose. And meanwhile, you've got Guile and Chun-Li, who both have their own vendettas with him and Shadow Liu, who are both kind of also coming after him in the background as well. You've got cameos from fighters like T-Hawk, Dalsim, Honda. There's a great apartment fight scene between Chun-Li and Vega. It's just far, far superior top to bottom. And it goes to show, see, it can be done. And just all because Capcom had this idea that they felt that movies about fighting tournaments were played out.
I would point them to any number of boxing movies.
Oh, sure. Sure. Christ. It's not always about innovation. Sometimes it's about iteration.
The irony about that is that the lead of this thing was in not one but two different movie series featuring fights. Fucking Bloodsport and Kickboxer. How do you mean the cognitive dissonance and all that?
You were Frank fucking Dukes. You mean to tell me you don't know how to make an all out fighting tournament interesting? Come on.
Another less goofy one, Warrior. Robert and I reviewed that a couple of years ago when we did a triple feature of combat sports movies. We did that with the Halle Berry one that was on Netflix. And I don't remember the third one. But we talked about Warrior. And, you know, that movie's got a couple of different, like, that's about mixed martial arts, about a cage fight. I mean, it's not about, that's the background to it. It's about a lot more than that. But there's a lot of fighting in that movie. Oh, and by the way, what's his nuts? Tom Hardy is awesome in that movie. Like, there are a few now, like, movie hero avatars that I want to project myself into. Tom Hardy, all stone cold, like, in black shorts, walking, that stomping down to the cage, no music, punching a guy in the mush and walking right back out again. Tom Hardy, you're my hero.
You know, here's a little throwback to something I said often back in the day. My favorite action stars are the ones who project a very legit aura. The idea of, you know, that there's not a whole lot of trickery needed to make them very, very convincing. Again, exhibit A would be, well, Jean-Claude Van Damme and Steven Seagal. But modern day, I think one of kind of the last real action stars of that breed standing is Tom fucking Hardy. Yeah. There's obvious character there, but at the same time, it's this Charles Bronson-like mystique of, you have no doubt that he'd be good for it if it came down to a real life scenario like
that. Can you imagine what they could have done with Tom Hardy as Venom if it wasn't an incompetent studio doing it?
Oh, good God.
That same movie, but not done in a rush with CGI blobs, and not, as much as I like, you know, as much as I like the idea, and it made me laugh when it was said, turning the second movie into this polyqueer love story between Tom Hardy and his CGI blob. Look, I laughed and I enjoyed it, but I'm just thinking maybe there's a better idea out there where you let Tom Hardy be Tom Hardy and just kick ass and take names and be awesome.
Yeah, I think you take that same movie, you give it to Jon Favreau.
Yeah.
Or the brothers who finished the Avengers.
Oh, the Avengers. Brothers.
The Russos, yeah. You give that to Jon Favreau or the Russos, you know, a couple of more competent storytellers. Or maybe you let someone with some serious horror chops, like a James Wan director.
Oh, you took the words out of my mouth. Like, yeah, give Venom to James Wan, and now you got something.
Yeah, so, give me a Venom movie made by fucking Blumhouse.
Yeah. I would watch this again with my son because he's not attached to the video game. So for him, this is going to be G.I. Joe. And I think he'll like it. Because much like Annihilation, if you have no attachment to the video game and you're just watching a children's action movie, it still needs to shave 10 to 20 minutes off of this thing. It's still a little too over long, but I think for the most part, children's action movie, this works just fine. Fans of the video game fails miserably. Adult action, just go watch Commando. Or Rambo First Blood Part 2. Look, if you want to see a guy in a beret running through the jungle killing foreigners,
there's
so many other movies you could watch that are better than
Street Fighter. Wasn't this produced by? It was either produced by someone who produced
Edward R. Pressman, and Kenzo. So let me look at. Let's see.
This has I remember from my research this had the involvement of someone who was involved with those two movies. Might have been Pressman.
So I'm looking at some of the movies that he either was the producer or executive producer on. Just a couple of things that ring out. I'm just going to kind of blurt these out here. The Crow, Bad Lieutenant. No, suck his dick. Bad Lieutenant. There's a movie we need to talk about someday. Talk Radio. let's see. He was an executive producer on Masters of the Universe. Ugh. Pirates of Penzance, Conan the Destroyer, Conan the Barbarian, American Psycho. That's him. Let me look at Kenzo here. Yeah, it doesn't say. All right, so I don't know. But yeah, just there's so many better movies that that you can watch if you want to see sweaty, muscly men running through a jungle killing foreigners. All right, that brings us to our last movie of the evening, and that is Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li, a 2009, I swear to God, I thought this was direct-to-video, it was so bad. Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li is a 2009 American crime film, sure it was, released as a non-canonical spin-off and theatrical tie-in to Street Fighter IV. Produced by Capcom and the Hyde Park Entertainment, the story follows the quest of Street Fighter character Chun-Li, who is portrayed by Kristen Kreuk as best as she can. Its story is before the events of the original Street Fighter, as it follows Chun-Li's personal history and her journey for justice. It co-stars Neil McDonough of Legends of Tomorrow fame and Flash, and I forget what else he did for the CW, as M. Bison, Chris Klein as Charlie, Michael Clark Duncan. I had to double check that was him as Balrog, and I'm like, oof, you are too good for this movie, pal. And Black Eyed Peas member Taboo as Vega. It was released February 27, 2009 by 20th Century Fox, now owned by Disney. And here's why. It was a critical and commercial failure. Legendary is redoing the Street Fighter series. It had a budget of $50 million and bombed miserably at $12.8 million. Here's what I said to you and a bunch of our guys in the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network group chat. I've watched a lot of the CW shows. And I kind of accept there's a quality about these shows that, you know, it's about here. And I accept that. And I don't get too bent out of shape as long as it stays around that level. And some are better than others. You know, The Flash, for the most part, was good. Arrow was up and down, but for the most part was good. Jesse and I loved Legends of Tomorrow. And I'm kind of mad at myself that I haven't finished watching that. Supergirl started off on CBS and had a, you know, and finished its run on the CW and was fan-fucking-tastic. I loved the shit out of Supergirl. Most of the time with the Greg Berlanti superhero shows, they were able to keep up the quality. Then there's Batwoman, which I don't want to beat up on that show too much because it's going to make me sound like I'm one of the neckbeards who just don't like, you know, superhero shows with women in it. I just fucking said I love the Supergirl show. I'm sorry, Batwoman wasn't that good. Batwoman, one of the problems with it, which I'm going to relate now to this, is it relied too heavily on, look, girl lead, and did not, and a little too heavily on convoluted, soapy plot lines, and not enough on anything else, and nor did it make those things any good. So it's sort of like it's begging you to like it just because it's got a chick lead in it, which doesn't really work for me. And that's kind of The Legend of Chun-Li. One, again, it's got that CW Greg Berlanti TV quality to it. So it's, you know, kind of shit. I kind of said jokingly, but I was also being somewhat serious. This felt like the pilot of a Chun-Li show. Like, take the first hour, take the first, like, maybe hour to 45 minutes of this and just make that a pilot to a show and then, you know, draw this out for 8 to 10 episodes. And you got yourself a halfway decent. It reminded me of the, you know, you and I didn't talk about it. Me and Ronnie did, but I'm sure you've seen it because it's sort of, you know, famous now or infamous, as it were. The Aquaman television show that only the pilot's available because it got canceled shortly after that.
You know, that wasn't what I was thinking of. What I was thinking was it feels like something that back in the 90s during the Monday Night Wars, mm-hmm. like a show on either TNT or USA. That would have gotten at least a 2 or 3 season run just because it was pulling strong ratings because it was on right after Raw or Night and Raw or Nitro.
What was the one with the chick superhero at, that was
real? La Femme Nikita?
Yes! I knew it was something like that. La Femme Nikita. Yeah, yep. That's that kind of quality. Basic cable.
Yeah, it's La Femme Nikita. It's that like I said, that Mortal Kombat series that was on TNT, or the New Adventures of Robin Hood, or Witchblade.
Yeah, I was gonna say, or like, you know, what do you call it? The Lucy Lawless show that everyone loves.
Xena Warrior Princess. Yeah. Yep.
There was a show that Ronnie and I did a whole bunch
of. Oh god, if only this movie had Sam Raimi directing it.
Anyway, so here's the thing. This is as much a Street Fighter movie. This is even less a Street Fighter movie than the last one called Street Fighter.
Oh yeah.
This is, you know, just a dramatization of this woman's revenge story that they took characters, crossed their names out, and wrote in Street Fighter characters. Michael Clark Duncan is awesome and is much better than this movie and deserves much better. He's as much Balrog as I am. They have a guy dressed in Vega cosplay, and that's about as close to that as it gets.
It's so weird because in the game, the whole point of Balrog is supposed to be, he's supposed to be a Mike Tyson analog who was pretty much exiled from the world of boxing because he was too dirty, too violent, and he kind of found his second calling as one of the four gods of Shadaloo, alongside Vega, Sagat, and of course Bison. And both movies get him so absolutely wrong.
Neil McDonough is awesome. I love him as a character actor, but he's doing his villain role from everything else I've ever seen him in. He's as much M. Bison as I am. Again, this was somebody's fucking pilot script for a kick-ass martial arts action girl thing, and they crossed it out and threw Street Fighter on it and were like, quick, make money with this. And bombed.
And let's face it, Raul Julia trimmed more charisma off of stray toenails than I think Neil McDonough has possessed in his entire life.
That's not fair to Neil McDonough. Because Neil McDonough, first of all, is no Raul Julia. I'm not debating that point.
No.
But Neil McDonough has a smarmy, vindictive, you know, evilness to him. At the end of Legends of Tomorrow, where they tried to redeem him, he still came across as shitty. And we love him for that. We, you know, when you need an absolute, just unrepentant bag of shit to oppose your hero, you call Neil McDonough. Now,
which is great, but Bison is an absolute scenery chewing, almost stock villain, but he works. It's like if you had Stephen Wright play Dr. Octopus.
Spider-Man, I put a dehumidifier and a humidifier in the same room and I let him fight it out. Spider-Man.
Yeah,
why is the alphabet in that order?
Don't get me wrong. It's not that you can't appreciate what Neil McDonough does well, but for this role, his arms are not long enough to box with God.
That's fair. I really don't have a whole lot else to say about The Legend of Chun Li. I mean, like, how much more time are we going to say?
Really.
You know, the fights are meh. The cinematography, a lot of the craft elements are like as basic gets. It's weird. This is less porn quality than the first Street Fighter movie, which is odd because the other one had a bigger budget. But
craft wise, it's a good looking movie. I'll give it that.
That's the thing, and that's actually the last thing I want to say. Like, I criticized the first one a lot because that one had every reason to be better than it was and failed miserably. So that's a lot of my criticism is driven by disappointment. This one, my problem with this is that it's not so bad it's good. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't the kind of thing that Jason and I were like, you know, Sharks of the Corn. It's like not over the top silly. You know, instead, it's a movie that takes itself seriously. It's just shoddy. And it's like, there's not a whole lot I can say about it. I can't appreciate it even for its kitsch value. It's not kitschy. Like this movie thinks it's badass.
It
in the way that Batwoman thought it was badass.
It has the visual ambition that Street Fighter the movie wishes it had, that it wishes it could have pulled off. But unfortunately, it also wastes that by once more failing absolutely miserably in the story execution and character development department.
You as an audience member have to recognize the characters on screen from the IP of which that you fell in love with in the first place. If you can't do that much, if you don't understand the IP well enough, don't do this. Like, or get people that can, or step out of the way and get people that can. And that's my really only remaining remark about all three of these movies. One, quality counts. Don't rush these things. You know, if you can't get it done in the window of time in which something is popular, then you're just going to have to rest on make a good movie and hope it all works out. Because I will tell you, I will tell you that even if you miss the window in which something is popular, if the movie is good enough, people will come. I mean, it's not like people don't go to see movies that have good word of mouth.
Yeah, that bears noting, because Mortal Kombat Annihilation and Street Fighter the movie in particular were notoriously rushed. I think I remember that Street Fighter the movie had less than a year to produce an adaptation of one of the hottest recognized commercial properties of the time, Street Fighter. Easily at that time, Capcom's biggest success story. And it needed so much more than that, and so much more of a budget, and so much less of the executives trying to butt in and insisting that it need to be done their way, because they wanted to butcher everything that their people had built. And that's the saddest part, is the fact that this fan in Street Fighter the movie, this fan came along and just wanted to make the movie about the game and the characters that he loved, and Capcom wanted anything but that. Kind of like how with the first Mortal Kombat movie, Paul W.S. Anderson, of all possible directors, comes along and, with a couple of minor quibbles aside, manages to take all the characters from the first two Mortal Kombat games, or as many as he could anyway, and not only choose the right ones to showcase, but to really nail them pretty much letter perfect on the first go. And then the Mortal Kombat Annihilation comes along, and you've got all these new cooks in the kitchen, and poor Talisa Soto and Robin Shu, who are just kind of trying to go with the flow as best they can. And meanwhile, yeah, you could kind of recognize the characters just enough to be pissed, because you knew who they were supposed to be trying to portray, and it sucked. And you were mad because it sucked. But no, you're doing it. No, not like that. Don't do it like that.
Not that way, James.
Like the Halo guys.
No.
Nerds. We haven't played your game, and we're not gonna play it. Enjoy our show.
I haven't said it in a while, so I'll say it again, especially because in case you're new to the show. Halo, the show that fucking broke me and nearly drove me off podcasting. Yeah.
Really? Well, Halo?
So Halo comes at the tail end of me reviewing everything just to review it. To the point where I was not liking podcasting anymore. And at the same time, like, my social life kind of blew up because, you know, I was doing the open relationships thing at the time. But, yeah, and then I sat down and reviewed it with Ronnie and Dave, and that... You know, it was like, there are a handful of shows where it was hard to get an hour's worth of discussion out of it. That was one of them. And the other one was the show I did with Alexis, where, but at least that one, we both got to look at each other. We're like, 30 minutes of this, we're just like, and we're done here. It was a Hellstrom. But like, Hellstrom didn't make me want to make me stop podcasting. Halo did. Halo is the reason why I kind of threw the reins at Alexis and here you do it. Like, I can't do this anymore. I can't fucking talk about all these horrible shows.
Yikes.
Yeah, Halo was so bad. And the conversation about it was even worse. So,
well, and as media based on video games go, I'll say this, there's cause for optimism. There absolutely is. Castlevania was not a complete disaster. It fell off.
Oh, that was up and down. Robert and I reviewed the anime for that, and some of those seasons we liked a lot, and some of it we were like, shoot me.
Yeah, but you can't say it was patently bad all the way through, that there weren't significant bright spots.
No, I said that. I said there were some seasons where we were like, this is awesome. And then there were a couple of stuff towards the end where we were like, shoot me.
Right. Right. But Twisted Metal was good, got a well deserved second season.
Yeah, I reviewed that with somebody and they thought it was good.
I am cautiously optimistic about Fallout. Fallout looks like it might actually be good.
Hey, you know what an obvious one is? Just kind of going, you know, it's an obvious one. Probably the best example of sticking purely to the source material and the intellectual property and giving a love letter to the fans, but also making a solid movie was Super Mario.
You know, I have heard nothing but good things about the anime of Super Mario.
Honestly, if there weren't 10 other movies I would rather have put in my top 10, it would have made it initially made my top 10. I wasn't expecting, you know, Wonka and the Color Purple to be as good as they were. Well, but when I originally made my top 10, it was in it.
And Sonic the Hedgehog was good.
Oh, Sonic the Hedgehog was great. It's just not as close to the game as, you know, as Super Mario was, you know, with the human stuff. All right. That being said, that is our review of Mortal Kombat Annihilation, Street Fighter, and The Legend of Chun-Li. Let's see. Sean and I will be back in a couple of weeks, I think. So with Black History Month coming up, me and Jason have a lot of stuff going on. When are you back? You are back. Not for a while. Let me look it up this way.
I'll make it easy for you. Just wait for the next time he goes live on some other show and just keep an eye on the chat. I get in there and do my Mike Nelson thing.
All right. The next one that I can see, the ones that I've written down here with your name on it, are March 5th. We are doing an on trial for Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby. We did a Baz Luhrmann triple feature, and it was the Red Curtain trilogy. We did A Long Road to Ruin.
And we had so much fun, we decided to keep it going.
Yeah, we were like, we have to talk about The Great Gatsby now.
Yeah.
So we're going to do an on trial for that, give it its own show. Him and theoretically Andrew Graham are going to come on, and I'm going to judge the on trial civil court edition for Roadhouse, 1989 versus the 2024, of which the trailer dropped today, and I did a trailer reaction on my TikTok, and it's the most popular thing I've done in months. How about that? Many, many moons ago, me and Chris, somebody or other from the Casual Heroes, did half the Lethal Weapon movies and never went back to it. So I'm going to throw that in the trash, and we're going to start all over again. So myself and Sean, on April 16th, are going to do all four Lethal Weapon movies. And then it's a month early because Sean is getting married, so we decided to do, as we say, in February we do black shit, in June we do gay shit, and in July we do shark shit. So we're doing all of our gay shit in May instead of June.
Yep, a little bit early.
And we are kicking things off with, I think this might be my favorite triple feature of this year. The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, and Hedwig and the Angry Inch. That's what's kicking off Pride Month, a month early. Then we are doing a Wachowski people focus. We're looking at Bound, Cloud Atlas, and Jupiter Ascending. And then on May 21st, we are looking at Milk, Kinsey, and Lizzie. And then in June, we are finally getting around to our David Lynch, I think. No. Yes, maybe. No. God, who did The Killer Didn't 7 and Zodiac? David Lynch
already?
We did David Lynch. I'm thinking of the wrong guy. Who did The Killer 7 and Zodiac?
David Fincher.
Yeah, I knew it was one of the Davids. So yes, we'll be doing a David Fincher director focus triple feature, looking at The Killer from Netflix, which was on a lot of people's top tens last year, 7 and Zodiac. So that's what we got. There's more than that, though. Hang on. Somewhere in there is another weird one that we're doing, you and I.
So I going to need to re-up my Netflix membership?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
April 4th, we're doing Waking Life, Run Lola Run, and Marriage Story.
Ah.
Yeah. And I know there's another triple feature in here somewhere with this particular weirdo director that we wanted to look at.
Didn't we want to do a Jim Jarmusch episode at one point?
Yes.
I thought about that because I scrolled past Ghost Dog the other night.
Yeah, and that's in here somewhere. We got a triple feature. Some of these I just don't have your name on for. I got to go back and add them in there. We're doing a triple feature for Judy Chaplin and Stan and Ollie. That's April 30th. And somewhere in here I'll figure it out. I tell you it's here somewhere. You know what? No, this is bothering me. Coffee and cigarettes. Yes. March 21st. We're doing Coffee and Cigarettes, Ghost Dog, and whatever other one you picked by that particular director. That's what it was. I think that's the Jim Jarmusch one, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I believe so.
Yes, you have to pick a Jim Jarmusch film before then. All right. That's what Sean's doing, and maybe me. next week, this week, actually, let me start with what happened this week. This week, we did Sons of Anarchy Season 1, Disenchantment Part 5. Earlier today, I was on Movies That Don't Suck and Some That Do, and we reviewed American Fiction and Saltburn. Ugh, Saltburn. Next that week, bad? Oh my god. Next week, we're going to be looking at some of the Best Picture movies in a triple feature. We're going to do Past Lives, Maestro, and The Holdovers. That's myself and Robert Winfrey. Another on trial where I'm going to be judging. This one is Dorian and his friend Mac Kettner. They're going to be defending and prosecuting the Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern movie. By their request, by the way. We kick off Black History Month with the following triple feature, The Blackening, Black Christmas 2019, and Meet the Blacks. Raise your hand if you got the subtle theme of this one. And that's going to be me and Jason and Dorian, in theory. And then finally, February 1st, Evan Bevins and I are going to be doing a actor focus. We're going to be looking at the vivacious Jennifer Garner, and we're going to review Family Switch, Elektra, and Peppermint. Because, you know, why not have dramatic whiplash? Sean, check me out. I'm at Mark Rattledge on TikTok. And then if you found this podcast, then you know where all of our other podcasts are. Sean, show them where you twitch and shout.
Follow me on Twitch, Instagram, and Threads. I'm still working on getting a streaming schedule set up. So that's kind of on hiatus right now. But if you follow me and you hit the notification bell, you will be let know anytime I happen to decide to up and go live. In the meantime, I will instead again affirm several different sources that I dove into to research for this episode. Again, Thorgy's Arcade, tremendous fighting game centric website. The ongoing Street Fighter retrospective, we're four episodes in, I think 2 to 4 episodes to go. I have learned so much about the bizarre development of this IP that all things considered never should have been. To borrow a line from Joey Styles, never had any business drawing a dime and ended up making an absolute boatload of money. Again, for both Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat, I will throw out Matt McMuscles, and especially his series, What Happened, as well as Worst Fighting Game Ever and Flophouse Plays, are excellent. Just a top-notch channel. I especially like that he's a former QA tester who opines and throws his research into game development. And if you want to see a good Street Fighter story, go watch Street Fighter II, the animated movie, or really any of the anime movies are going to be far better than the movies that we talked about tonight. Street Fighter Iron Assassin's Fist looks, it has my curiosity enough so that I'll check it out. It looks to have about comparable polish to Legend of Chun-Li, but we'll see if the story's any better. And as far as Mortal Kombat goes, the animated movies are a little bit hit and miss. Mortal Kombat 2020, I think it was 2021, either 2021 or 2022, one or the other.
2021,
yeah, I thought so. really nailed it visually, but again, story, not quite there, but going in the right direction. Or just go and watch a cutscene movie of the entire rebooted saga from Mortal Kombat 9 onward, and you'll see what I mean about just how much deeper these games go in terms of lore and world building than they need to.
Folks, thank you for joining us here on Triple Feature. He's Sean, you're not. I'm Mark. Be well, be safe, and behave.